Well, first I want to thank you for the opportunity to get this interview. And I'd like to let you know that I've been a fan of yours for many years. Are we ready? I'll start if you are.
Anytime.
Okay, and I'm recording this, by the way.
Okay.
Would you tell us about your background and what brought you to the study of UFOs and some of the books you've written?
Well, I was, I suppose, mildly interested in the subject when I was a child living in Rutland, Vermont, back in the 50s. There were a lot of sightings back then, we now know, and made it into the newspapers, and I can remember that as a book to read, one of several books I had to read every semester, I chose the report on unidentified flying objects by Edward Ruppelt, who was the first director of Project Blue Book. And I read the book and wrote a little review of it, I guess. I lost the review many, many years ago. I still have the book. It's all dog-eared and so on now, because I only read it once in the late 50s. You know, there wasn't anything I could do about it except think, that's interesting. And then wasn't until the middle 60s when I was going to American University in Washington, D.C. to get a Ph.D. in physics that UFOs came out of the woodwork, you might say, in 65, 66, 67 time frame. There was a big flap of sightings in the Midwest in the 66, and that caused Congress to direct the Air Force to conduct a supposedly independent study of the subject that is independent of Project Blue Book. And at that time, it became acceptable to talk about UFOs without having a bag over your head. I suppose a key event was going to a lecture at American University by two guys from NICAP. I suspect it was Richard Hall and Don Berliner, but it might have been somebody else. In any case, I don't remember much about the lecture, but I do recall him saying that NICAP was a volunteer organization and they needed help in the main office to answer mail and so on. And, of course, NICAP was National Investigating Committee on Aerial Phenomena. It's been sort of regenerated in a new form on the web in honor of the original name, I guess. It was founded by a guy by the name of Townsend Brown in 1956. And then almost immediately, Donald Kehoe became the director in 1957. It had been around for like 10 years by the time I got interested, about 1968. So anyway, it was in a number of UFO books. I had read a couple of UFO books by that time, starting in 66, I suppose, or 67. And since NICAP was mentioned in the UFO books, I naturally expected this as well. It was said to be the biggest civilian UFO organization. I imagined their office, which was described as being downtown in Washington, D.C., big place with lots of people running around doing all sorts of stuff, and secretaries and scientists and whatever. So in the late fall of 68, I believe it was, I went to where the NICAP office was, 1536 New Hampshire Avenue in Washington, D.C., down near a place called DuPont Circle. And back in those days, around DuPont Circle were a lot of row houses. It's all built up into modern office buildings now, but people actually lived in the area in those days. And so I went to this entranceway, which had the right number, and it turned out to be a doorway with no door on it, into a hallway, and up the stairs you had to go. And there was a light bulb at the top of the stairs, but bare walls and stairs, up to another door. My anticipation was waning at that point.
I could imagine.
I opened the door, and there was a small suite of rooms, packed wall to wall and floor to ceiling with books and papers and stuff. Old broken-down secretary who was running the whole show. So there was one person that I met. And that was disappointing, shall I say. As I said, I had envisioned this to be a big organization. But by the time I got there, Donald Kehoe had left. I could see his desk piled up with papers, but nobody was there. The other names that I had read about weren't there either. Nevertheless, I figured, well, if I'm here, at least I have some access to the files, and then I can make up my own mind as to what's going on. So I actually did some volunteer work and opened some letters, and the secretary, Isabel Davis, who was a very astute young mentally lady, wanted me to write up, wanted if I could write up a one-page, what we now call a Q&A sheet, that she could type in with a special typewriter she had that had very small, I don't know, 8-point or something type.
One of those elite typewriters.
I don't know. Yeah. It's very small type. She wanted to be able to put everything on one page because she says we get, you know, tons of mail. What I need is one-page thing that you can fold up, stick in an envelope, and mail out immediately. To respond. And they get letters like, send me everything you have on UFOs. For which the correct response would be, okay, send a truck. And I did that. That was, what, in 68 or 69. 5 or 6 years later, when NICAP was being removed from Washington, D.C. and transferred elsewhere, I was going through what was remaining of the files, and sure enough, here was a couple of copies of the thing that I had written, you know, several years before. So I know she actually used it. Anyway, by being active in the sense of doing some volunteer work, I was able to connect up with the local NICAP subcommittee. NICAP was an organization sort of unlike MUFON, the present main organization. NICAP had a headquarters. But it had independent subcommittees, that is, the subcommittees spread throughout the United States with the organizations that actually had meetings, you know, and did the investigations and wrote reports and sent them back to headquarters. So the Washington, D.C. subcommittee was run right out of the NICAP office. And I met some of those people, actually went on a UFO investigation, I guess, in 1969. And it turned out to be interesting. A lady who had seen, who had been driving along a road that's in the western suburbs of Washington, D.C., called Tuckerman Lane, and she saw green lights flying over her car as she drove along. So we went to her house. It was a nice apartment house, row house, I guess, and she was a teacher, her husband was an accountant. People who weren't likely to be making a UFO hoax. And we got in her car and rode with her along the same road. We couldn't think of any, couldn't see any reason, or trees on each side, you know. We couldn't see any reason for there to be green lights appearing to pass over the car. There was a stoplight, but that's only green temporarily. And, of course, everybody knows what a stoplight is. So that one had to go into the files as unidentified. Perhaps a key point here is that, is in comparison with other people. Other people I've read that other people have written that they started to get interested in the subject. I actually went out to do some case investigations and turned out that the cases turned out to be complete misidentifications or hoaxes or something that wasn't very interesting at all. And after doing several investigations like that, the person would just sort of drop out or become skeptical of the whole subject.
Well, I can understand that.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that too. I mean, if that was the first one that I was on, and there were a few more. There was one that involved some children that probably a child seeing a strange sunset may have explained what was going on. But more important than that was a case from Mount Jackson, Virginia, which is in the Shenandoah Valley, of a guy who was a county official seeing for many, 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 many minutes an object hovering over one of the mountains out there. And he was able to triangulate on it and get an angular size, and he brought his family out to witness it as well. And it was, you know, a real solid case of something that was hovering over this mountain. And then another case that involved multiple witnesses and a landing craft and something very, very, very strange. So the first cases that I got involved with had some meat to them. And, of course, at the same time, I was studying what was going on. You know, this was the end of the 60s was sort of the end of NICAP. You know, it was the end of Project Blue Book, and once Project, the Condon study was the one that resulted from congressional pressure, the Condon study taking place in 68 and 69, and then publishing their results with Condon saying that 20 years of studying UFOs had led to no new knowledge, and he didn't think their the continued study was worthwhile. And
until he changed his mind, right, when he got older.
I don't know that Condon ever changed his mind.
I thought he did.
I don't recall anything indicating.
Well, maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, well, he basically read the whole subject off, and most of the, although the Condon study itself, if you read through the whole thing, there's a lot of scientific padding, you might say, chapters on optics and chapters on radar and so on. It turned out to be great value as a reference book for physical phenomena. But the Condon study tackled, I don't know, 90 to 100 cases. I've seen numbers fluctuate. Roughly, if you look in the index of the Condon study, you find 30 cases, I think it is, that are listed as unexplained. You can look up unexplained cases. You would think that a study done by skeptical scientists of a phenomenon that they claim is either misidentifications, hoaxes, or delusions, you'd think they'd be able to explain everything.
Well,
instead, the 30% unexplained is even larger than the Project Blue Book level of unexplained.
Right, right.
So,
well, isn't the accepted figure today somewhere around 10 or 12%?
Yeah, I was, I read statistics in a number of places just recently, and 5% to 10% has been a sort of a good number, but on reevaluation, some people put it as high as 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And the so-called special report number 14, which was done in 1952, 53, 54 by the Battelle Memorial Institute in conjunction with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Project Blue Book people. Now, that was never referred to by Condon, but it was no doubt the largest government, at least, statistical study ever carried out. It tackled 4,000 cases that were collected between 1947 and December of 1952. Threw away 800 of them right off as being too nebulous for good analysis, that leaving 3,201. And out of that, they claimed about 20-some percent unidentified from the whole group of cases. And then if you removed from your analysis all the civilian witnesses, so you were left only with military witnesses, many of whom were on duty at the time of their sightings, then the percentage of unexplained went up to about 30%.
Mm.
So it was like the better the cases, the more likely to be explained, to be unexplainable.
Right, I understand. The better the witness, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you say that basically your main interest now in UFOs is in analyzing photographs?
Well, that's sort of what I've been doing. I guess I got into that because of the McMinnville case that I tackled back in starting in '74. And I have learned a lot about photography and videography and so on over the years. So I end up reviewing a lot of stuff, but that's not the only thing I do. I also do historical studies, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And I was active years ago in the Freedom of Information Act. I got the first person to get a hold of the FBI file. Nobody even knew there was an FBI file.
Yeah.
Ruppelt in his book indicates that the FBI was never interested. Well, he didn't know.
Yeah, obviously, the FBI, right?
The FBI was like a black hole. Information came in, went in, and never and didn't come out until
right.
1977.
Well, let me ask you this. Many people, they mistakenly think today that they're photo analysis experts. I guess it's because of software like, you know, Photoshop and that. But tell us, as a professional photo analyst, what steps do you take to determine if a photo is genuine?
What you have to realize, first of all, is a photo a UFO does not make.
Right.
Now, a video or a movie with sound, that's more difficult to fake. But what it comes down to is the photo can't prove that the UFO is real. the best or worst it can do is provide evidence that there's a fake. And we've seen that in a number of cases, and I have some on my website. Just recently, as a matter of fact, August 2006 Chinese UFO video. It's on my website, the analysis of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was viewed by 500,000 people on YouTube, supposedly. I don't know what most, well, you know, you'd get comments like, wow, this thing, some of your audience may recognize it if I describe it. It shows a tall, narrow building at the left-hand side, and the UFO, a typical classic disc-shaped thing, on the upper right. And the UFO moves from the right towards the left. That is, it's sort of moving towards the direction of the building. And as it does so, the camera zooms in, and then the UFO gets to a certain place, and then all of a sudden, with a bright flash of light, it's gone. And if you look frame by frame, you can see that in one frame, there's a whole bunch of lights that appear around the edge of the object, and then in the next frame, it's gone. Well, I looked at this carefully, and when I first saw it, I noticed there was something weird going on, and when the camera zoomed in, to indicate the building. Well, we know the camera was zooming in because the building was increasing continuously. But the image size of the UFO didn't seem to continuously increase.
Mm.
So when I went down and analyzed it carefully, you know, frame by frame, it became clear that when you zoom in, you increase the magnification of the image. The magnification of the building did not match the magnification of the UFO. Or maybe
right.
I should say it the other way around.
No,
we
think
know
we
the building
understand.
Was real. at least it certainly seems reasonable that the building was real. So it would measure what the zoom factor or magnification would be, but the UFO image did not grow at the same rate.
Hmm.
And then that one frame flash showed lights around the edges of the object, and there were seven lights, and if they had been equally spaced around the disk, which is what you were supposed to assume, then they would have occurred in a certain locations with respect to the image, looking at it obliquely from below. You're not directly beneath it. You're looking at an angle. And it turned out the positions of the lights didn't agree with how they would appear if it had been a real object out there with seven lights spaced equally around the edge. So there were a couple of things that were wrong with that video.
Right. Well, you know, I saw something, a video I was looking at, and something came to mind. It was a video of a UFO where a cluster of UFOs appeared in the background, and it was against the sky. There were no buildings. There was nothing, not even a cloud in the sky. And I said to myself, how could anybody tell whether the cluster was moving or the camera was moving, because the cluster was going one way, the big UFO was going another way apparently, but it could have been the big UFO was standing still and these were balloons and they were drifting another way, or somebody was moving the camera. I just don't see, without reference points, how can you analyze it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Well, like I said, a photo of a UFO does not make, but what does tend to make it is the backup, the context, the surrounding history, what happened before, what happened afterwards. In the McMinnville case that many of your listeners may be familiar with from 1950, it's a classic UFO disc, two photographs taken by a farmer. His wife saw it first, yelled for him to bring the camera, and he took the picture.
Is that the one where it's over the roof?
You see a building on the left-hand side,
yeah,
which is the garage.
Right, that's the picture.
It's not really over the garage. It's to the right of being
right,
over the garage.
Right, you that's the picture I meant.
You see two pictures. One is, you see the oval bottom of it, an oval image of the bottom, presumably circular. Actually, it's not quite circular. And then you see a more edge-on picture. And that's been in great dispute, you know, over years. Now, it happened in 1950, and the trends died in 1995 and 96. So you could follow their whole life from the time those pictures were taken to afterwards. And I sort of did that, I guess. I started interviewing them in 1975 or 76. I talked to Mrs. Trent many times. I collected interviews done by other people over the years, put a huge analysis on my website. And so the bottom line is, you can't prove The skeptics initially had argued you could prove by the photos that it was a hoax. And I counteracted their arguments and said basically the photos don't prove it's real or prove it's a hoax. So you have to, it's either the real thing or a hoax. There's no halfway point.
All right, I understand.
So these are the high-risk, high-payoff cases where there's no doubt that it's either the real thing or it's a hoax.
Well, how do you feel about it?
Let me finish
this. Yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Since you can't prove by the picture that it was a hoax, the best you can do is say the picture is neutral. It provides, it acts as an aid to the memory of the witness. You know, what did you see? Well, here, I got this photograph, see, and I saw that. If the photo doesn't prove it's real by itself, then you have to look at everything else. And so we start looking at the Trent's background history and, you know, things that they were doing. Turned out that every day Mr. Trent, well, the skeptics had claimed that this thing was taken in the morning. But the witnesses, Trent, said that the pictures were taken in the evening, just before sunset. So the skeptics had an argument that, well, they faked the pictures in the morning, but they knew that they couldn't say that they saw a UFO in the morning because farmers are more likely, this is a rural area they were in, farmers are more likely to be up in the morning, and then there would be a question of, well, why didn't anybody see it? But in the evening, about sunset, farmers would be in their house eating, and so it would be easier to say we saw it in the evening, and nobody else saw it because they were all inside their houses. That was a sort of a skeptical argument. Well, it turned out that in that, Mr. Trent was a farmer. He had his own farm. He had his own cows, and he also did a milk run. So he'd get up like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, take care of his own animals, and then start his milk run. And when you're doing a milk run, you know, you've got other farmers out there with cows that are loaded with milk, and they have to be handled. They have to be taken care of. So you don't stop at 7:30 in the morning and make a UFO photo and then go on your milk run.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
It's that sort of thing, yeah. You know, the contextual evidence. And, of course, numerous people who interviewed the Trent said, you know, you just look at these people and you know that they couldn't pull off a hoax.
Yeah, right.
So it was the background stuff.
I understand.
That is the convincing part, and the photos just sort of are neutral. Now, that happens. There are cases where you can say, well, if this was faked, then it was very difficult. For example, it would require the will to do it, obviously, the intelligence to do it, and in some cases, special equipment to do it. Now, in recent years, we've had lots of situations where people will make a photo montage or whatever, simply, very easily done with things like Photoshop and so on. And especially the cases that are anonymous, there are a number of anonymous ones that have come off on the Internet. And people will look at them, and somebody who is uneducated in the subject will look at it and say, wow, look at that. But then somebody who is educated in the subject says, well, it's useless information, because without knowing who did it, you can't go and talk to them and find out, you know, what's the story behind the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody who's anonymous simply publishes this story, I was walking outside and I had my camera with me because I was photographing butterflies and then this thing flew over and I took pictures of it. If you don't know anything, you don't know who the witness is, you can't verify the background story.
Right, I understand.
Anybody who's going to submit UFO photos had better be prepared for an FBI-level grilling. And furthermore, the closer it gets to being a real UFO, that is, the more difficult a hoax it would be, the tougher the investigation gets.
Well, let me ask this question. I saw where one photo analyst said that he would not even analyze a photo if it came from a computer monitor. Do you feel the same way about that?
Now you're talking Sanio?
Sanio, any kind.
Huh?
You mean the analyst himself?
Yeah, Jeff Sanio.
I don't know his name, actually.
Yeah, well.
I think there's a few of them that feel that way.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, because it can get very difficult. You know, you look at things like pixelation, and if you have brightness contours, that say a thing is against a background sky, and the background sky has brightness variations in it, you can put brightness constant brightness contours on the image, and look to see if any of them are broken at some area around the UFO, as if the UFO image had been pasted in. There are other things you can look for, and
would you examine a photo if somebody told you it came from a monitor? Or?
Well, Well, you mean somebody photographed the monitor?
I mean somebody who say, yeah, they dumped the photo to their monitor, to their computer, and then they took a picture from the monitor and they printed it and sent it to you.
The thing is, they'd never say it was taken from the monitor.
Well,
it would be stupid. They'd say it was taken outdoors.
Yeah, but, well, this analyst said he could spot them because there is a certain type of fringe around them.
Well, that's true. That fringing occurs around from a scanned, the fact that you're doing a scanning system. Almost everything has high contrast, that is dark thing against a bright background or a bright thing against a dark background, will have some sort of fringing effects that go on that you wouldn't get if it were a normal photograph, let's say, you know, like a film, a film camera photograph. But video cameras are notorious for that sort of thing. I was just looking at a video yesterday that somebody had where it was just a bright light, bright object against the background sky, but at the left side and the right side of this were dark areas. Now, the scanning goes from left to right or right to left, so it doesn't go top to bottom. So this left and right side dark areas sort of indicate the camera equipment, the electronics, responding to the sudden jump in brightness from the sky, either sky to something that's dark or the sky to something that's very bright.
I understand. So in other words, you would know right away if somebody tried to give you a photo that was from a computer. That's all I was really asking.
Well, if they took a picture, if they had a film picture, a film photograph of a computer screen, aside from the fact that you could try to see if you can see the individual pixels, the image on the screen itself would be carrying whatever damning information there was.
Right. I read that while you were working for the Navy, your research was into lasers. Is that correct?
I did some, yes.
When you've analyzed photos, have you ever encountered any photos that would indicate to you that a UFO had a laser on board or was using some sort of amplified light in their propulsion system?
No. Closest, I am aware of two photos of a beam of some sort. Now, I'm not saying it's a laser beam.
Mm-hmm.
It probably isn't. From Gulf Breeze, Florida, back in the 1980s, 1988, or 1987, I guess it was, in 88. It shows a UFO in the sky and a beam coming downwards from it. Blue beam. Blue beams have been reported in UFO sightings over years, for many years. And this is, as far as I know, the only actual photograph of such a thing.
No, Timothy Good told me a story about an attack on a Russian radar site where a UFO shot a beam that passed through a sentry without hurting him and blew up the radar site. Have you ever heard that one?
I think I have vaguely recalled something like that. I didn't remember the detail of a beam going through a person and then blowing up something on the other side.
That's pretty incredible, isn't it?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be a laser beam.
That's what you... how many photographs do you estimate that you've analyzed over the years?
Hundreds? I don't know. I got enough to worry about the stuff that enough to clog up my mind with the cases that are worth, that have turned out to be worthy of study, without trying to remember all the ones that weren't.
I can
many,
imagine.
Many times, you know, somebody will send me something and I'll spend 5 or 10 minutes at the most on it and say, either it's a hung jury or forget it. I've got, you know, a number of things just lying down, in my collection of other people's stuff. You know, this is not stuff that is mine in a sense of to do with whatever I want.
I think we all have
a lot of news organizations contact me and say, please send me all the UFO video you've got or something to that effect. And I tell them, well, you know, I have stuff, you know, but my job is not to supply the news media with all sorts of stuff, and furthermore, it's not mine anyway. You got to get permission from whoever's the owner.
Right.
So, since I passed the buck that way.
I think we all have those collections. When a UFO is photographed over water, does it distort the finer points of the photograph? I mean, for example, when the photo is given an extreme enlargement and the UFO was only a few feet above the waves, does rising vapor affect the clarity of the object?
Well, I've never seen, I don't recall seeing a picture where the UFO was only a few feet above the waves, so I don't know. I do recall a photograph taken from the Bahamas or someplace. I can't remember. It was West Indies, some area, I can't remember, because it was years ago since I've seen it, where there were some people on a sailing vessel, I believe it was, at a dock, and they're looking out over an expanse of water, and they see an object come up out of the water, sort of tilt back and forth as if it were shaking the water off and then take off. Well, this guy had a camera, and he was photographing the scenery, and he photographed this object, and he actually seemed to see water, a spray of water coming off it. I don't know, 10, 20, 30 feet above the ocean at that point when it happened. I wouldn't say that caused a distortion. The only other photo that I can think of offhand is another one from Gulf Breeze in April 1994 of an object that hovered over the Santa Rosa Sound and appeared to have sucked water up into it. But it didn't seem to do any strange optical distortion.
Could you account for the turbulence that you sometimes see around UFOs? What do you think causes that?
Well, it may mean, depend on how we define turbulence. France said when the thing took off, they thought it was at least 1,000 or 2,000 feet away from them. They said, when this thing took off to the left, shortly after they felt a big blast of wind, I would suggest that the object had pushed the atmosphere somehow or other.
Right.
And AC, a guy by the name of Urey in 1947, one of the first flying saucer craft cases from 1947, talking about an object that was flying down the Snake River Canyon. And he was inside the Snake River Canyon, which is what he said, about 1,000 feet wide where he is. And this object was going down the canyon 10 or 20 feet above the tree level, and he said the trees seemed to swirl around as the thing passed over, as if it were creating a swirling of the atmosphere. There have been other cases where there have been some atmospheric effects, and in some cases people think that some distortion or waviness of the atmosphere in the vicinity of a UFO is a result of something happening to the atmosphere. What could be happening? Well, a UFO could be actually forcing the atmosphere. Whatever the UFO uses for propulsion might actually be pushing the atmosphere as a side effect, not the main effect.
Do you think that maybe this might be due to some sort of anti-gravity field? Instead of pushing the atmosphere, it might change the gravity around these objects?
Well, if it changes the gravity around the object, who knows what's going to happen. If it decreases the gravity, it might make the atmosphere, a volume of the atmosphere go upwards, and if it increases the atmosphere, increases the gravitational effect, then maybe it'll make the atmosphere sink downwards. I don't really know. There could be other things that would happen if you actually did sizably change the gravitational field. Light coming through it might get bent in a strange way. I don't know that anybody has tried to work out what would happen if you had some volume inside the atmosphere where the gravitational field. I can tell one thing that would happen. If you reduce the gravitational field, the coupling between the Earth and a particular volume of atmosphere would be low at less. And that volume of atmosphere would therefore weigh less. It would start to rise upwards, and it might also get a displacement, a horizontal displacement, because the Earth is rotating at a particular speed. And if this element of atmosphere suddenly were lighter, it would get pushed sideways by the heavier, unaffected atmosphere. So you might get some lateral distortion, lateral movement of a volume of atmosphere as well as a vertical movement.
I've been very interested in some of the sightings of UFOs in Mexico over the years, and I was told that you analyzed the Mexican UFO sighting of August 6, 1997.
Right.
That's the one with the video showing a lot of UFO flying over a building in Mexico. Could you tell us what your findings were?
Well, again, this is on my website. Probably I should tell you what my website is since I've mentioned
it. Yeah, tell us what it is. And
www.brumac.8k.com. Brumac.8k.com.
Got it.
Or you can simply Google on my name, Bruce McAbee. Anyway, the video from August 6, 1997 from Mexico City looked very good. This object is at the left-hand side of a apartment building, and it's rotating. At the very beginning of the video, it's rotating and wobbling and so on. And then it moves to the right in the field of view, appears to go behind the building, then come up from above the building, travel along, going towards the right, and then all of a sudden it moves. It's been a long time since I looked at it, but it appears to go off into the distance anyway. On the building, you see, of course, a whole bunch of windows in the building. It's a big apartment building, and you see little wind socks that are posted at various positions along the building. I don't know why. I don't know what good it does them to know the direction of the wind. But that's what these little things are. They become of some interest because only when the camera is focused and not moving can you clearly see these wind socks. So anyway, Sanio, Jeff Sanio, another the official, I guess he's now the official MUFON photo analyst, and he's had a big series of big articles in the MUFON Journal that you might have read on photo analysis. Anyway, he and I spent probably hundreds of hours analyzing this thing in various ways to try to understand. Now, this was an anonymous case. A story came along with it, which said that the person didn't want to come forward because he was illegally in Mexico, if I recall.
Sure, that's a twist, isn't it?
Yeah, from Nicaragua, and he was illegally in Mexico, didn't want to be deported. We could tell from the perspective view, first of all, Jaime Maussan, I presume you know who he is.
Oh, yes, I should.
He had this shown on TV soon after he got it. And let's see, it was in August 6th, supposedly, the date on the video. It wasn't until September that he got a hold of it. It was mailed to him with a letter saying that, you know, we saw this thing and we videotaped it and we can't come forward because it's either we or I. I can't remember whether it was several people or just one, but illegally in Mexico, and therefore we got a good job here, or don't want to get kicked out, or worse, that effect. So Maussan showed the video on TV. Somebody then called him up and said, I know where that is. I know the building. And sure enough, they were able to identify the building that's in the picture and then backtrack from the sight of line of sight to the building where this was taken. It turned out to be a building that had security guards around it. I don't know. I don't recall now what it was, what companies and so on were inside this building, but it was some building with housing a number of different corporations. And you can track everything. Furthermore, there were some supposedly ground witnesses to this thing. People who claimed that they had seen it, but nobody had come forward until after this video was shown. And so anyway, Sanio and I spent a lot of time on it because it looked like it had backup witnesses, and it was anonymous. It seemed to be, you know, pretty good video. But the more we analyzed it, the more it began to fall apart. And then finally, we discovered what I call the fingerprints of a hoax. If you go to the website, you can see the magnitude of the effect that I'm talking about. The camera was quite steady for most of the film, but not perfectly steady. And Sanio began to realize that if he plotted the fuzziness of the edges of the UFO versus the fuzziness of the edges of the building, the fuzziness of the edges being a result of camera motion. So in other words, if the camera is jiggling up and down, left and right, because you're holding the camera, you introduce a little bit of blur or fuzziness into the edges of everything. Well, now, camera motion blur should produce the same amount of fuzziness in every edge of the picture. What Sanyo began to notice was the fuzziness of the buildings was exceeding the fuzziness of the UFO. And that was raised a big question mark. How can that be? And then we found a couple of frames where it was entirely obvious, where the fuzziness due to camera motion completely blurred out these little windsocks, and of course the edges, the vertical and horizontal edges of the building were easy to compare. Vertical motion smears the horizontal edge. The edges of the building in a couple of frames were totally smeared. Guess what the edges of the UFO were? Unsmeared.
Yeah.
They looked exactly the same. And on the website, I've shown comparison pictures, you know. One frame before the smear and the frame of the smear, you can see that the building is blurred very badly, but the UFO looks just the same.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Has there been an improvement in the tools that are used to analyze photos since you started? And if so, in what way?
Well, there have been differences, I guess. I don't know. Since each case sort of demands its own type of analysis, there are certainly general principles you can use, but what is on the video is going to determine sort of what you do to analyze it. And it all comes down, I still think, to sweat, tears, and elbow grease. with, you know, some intelligence to know for a particular type of video what's the best thing to try to do. But the bottom line always is the video, the best the video can do is act as a recollection to the witness. If you don't have the witness, you don't really have a story.
Right.
So all these people, you know, I say to your audience that if you look at the videos that are out on the internet, they turn up on YouTube every day, I guess, nowadays. With no witnesses, you may as well just forget it. You're not going to be able to prove a thing.
Right. Have you ever analyzed or even seen your famous 1871 photo of that cigar-shaped UFO that purports to be the first UFO photo ever taken?
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, okay. We'll skip that then.
I mean, there have been a number of them from the old things from the old days, I guess. I recall something that was on the surface of Mount Washington, on the snowpack of Mount Washington, raised questions. It looked like a big cigar-shaped UFO.
I think we may be talking about the same one. This was above a mountain, and I think it was Mount Washington. Matter of fact, I saw it. This sounds crazy, but I saw it on the on a website on the internet, and somebody was trying to prove a case that it had a swastika on the side of it.
What?
Yeah, you believe that? Well, anyway, what is your opinion of the Phoenix lights? Do you think they were just flares, or do you think they were actually UFOs?
I think the things that were videotaped were flares. You know, the Phoenix case divides into two parts. And the media always goes for the throat. If you've got video involved, the video carries all the weight.
Right.
And you have to go back and look at the history of the Phoenix case to see what happened. If you look at the Phoenix case, we're talking about March 13, 1997. Most people don't realize it, but there were lights in the sky that were photographed and some videotaped before and after that, especially afterwards. Mm-hmm. Numerous videos taken afterwards of lights in the sky. And as a matter of fact, I began my own analysis by analyzing sightings that occurred in 1998, a year afterwards. But the thing about March 13, 1997 is the whole thing began with sightings near Prescott, Arizona, I believe it is, 50 or something miles north, or 100 miles, I'm not sure how far, north of Phoenix. And the National UFO Reporting Center started receiving phone calls from there, and they received phone calls working their way down towards Phoenix. And what's his name, in charge of the UFO Reporting Center, said that he could essentially see this object moving from the way the reports were coming in. It was moving south along a big highway, more or less. And then suddenly he got a lot of phone calls from the Phoenix area itself, people talking about this big triangular thing passing right over their heads. This is the time of Comet Temple, whatever it was.
Oh, yeah, the one, the comet that crashed into Jupiter?
No, that was a different one.
Oh, okay.
That was Levy, something, double name.
Shoemaker-Levy, right.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so people would be out in the evening looking at this comet. Well, they got more than they had bargained for. A number of witnesses have come forward in the year, in the early days and in the years since, saying that they saw this thing flying directly over their heads and it blocked out the stars and it had a triangular shape, and some people thought it was as big as a city block and so on, and didn't make any noise. They didn't think it was very high up, but they couldn't really tell because they didn't know how big it was. In any event, that's like at 8:30 that night. And this thing supposedly went southward from Prescott, Arizona, starting at 8 o'clock, down over Phoenix around 8:30, and then it continued presumably towards Tucson. And but that was the end of it for Phoenix people, that somewhere around 8:30 this thing passed over, and that was it. And I guess they started calling into the news media about their sightings. Well, now at about 10 o'clock that night, three people noticed that there were lights appearing off on the horizon southwest of Phoenix, and they got videos. And the next day, when the newspapers reporting about and news media is reporting about sightings that occurred at 8:30 the previous night, these people who got videos said, "Wow, we saw it, and we got videos of it." And so immediately the news media jumped on the videos and started showing them the very next day. And it became the Phoenix Lights case. And since nobody had video of a dark triangle flying over, they had to go with what they had, which was the lights. And so it all became Phoenix Lights instead of the Phoenix, well, it should have been the Phoenix Triangle case.
Mm.
Well, now, that happened on March 13th. There was an initial flurry of activity. What are these lights, you know, and the news media people called the Air Force, and the Air Force says, "We don't know. We didn't have anything up in the air." And, of course, there was all of the people saying it was all UFOs, and the UFO investigators sort of put together a story that this big triangle had flown over Phoenix at 8:30 and headed down towards Tucson. There were some reports in the Tucson area. And then it turned around and went back, and by 10 o'clock got back to someplace southwest or nearly over Phoenix, and then it turned its big lights on, and that's when everybody saw it. That was the way the initial story put together by the UFO investigators and bought lock, stock, and barrel, more or less, by the news media. So that, in other words, connected the triangle with the lights.
Right.
And the famous Mike Kristen arc, what I call the Kristen arc video, where you see these lights appearing one after another, starting on the right-hand side, they appear, and they move to the leftwards, and you hear him saying, "Hey, Sue, you've got to come out here and see this," talking to his wife. And, well, he had seen and videotaped these lights like this in the past, but always there had been just a couple of them. This was a spectacular sighting from his point of view. So a year later, I was invited by Lynn Katai, Dr. Katai, who has written a book that just came out 2 years ago on the subject. She was being anonymous at that point. Her video had been shown numerous times, and she had, in fact, promoted its use. But she was known as Dr. X at first, and then Dr. Lynn. She didn't want to release her complete name until actually her book came out. So back in 1998, she contacted me, asked me to look over her videos and also any of the others and try, because there had been this big controversy starting in, well, the sighting occurred in March 1997. As I said, there was an early amount of interest in the subject. Then it sort of faded out since the Air Force didn't admit to anything. Nobody could prove anything about it. Then in June, I think it was, of 1997, a public information officer at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson, Arizona, found out that there had been the Maryland National Guard was using the Goldwater Training Range, which is west of Tucson, for activities, and that they had been dropping flares as late as 10 o'clock that night. So all of a sudden, the flare theory flared up. And the witnesses said that couldn't possibly be. These things were hovering. They were not falling downwards. They were hovering steadily. They were very bright and golden yellow or orange colored or something like that. And they didn't have any smoke, and you couldn't see any parachutes. This couldn't possibly be flares. Furthermore, they'd never dropped flares over Phoenix. The witnesses thought these lights were over Phoenix, which is a key point of their own misidentification. Anyway, she called Lynn Katai, who had one of the videos. There were three videos taken by Mike Kristen, Lynn Katai, and Chuck Reardon. Reardon was 35 miles east of Mike Kristen. So when Lynn Katai says, "You know, I want you to look at this stuff," I said, "Okay, get me the videos," which she did. She got me a big map of the area, a contour map of the area, and by good fortune, I happened to have other business out there in Phoenix, and she was able to take me to the actual witnesses' places themselves, and I could determine from videos and stuff that I took of the area which directions they were looking. And ultimately, after weeks of effort, I managed to get all the information together and start plotting and making a triangulation. I could determine the sighting line from Mike Kristen's house, and I could determine the sighting line from Chuck Reardon's house. And these two sighting lines crossed, but not over Phoenix. They crossed about 60 to 80 miles southwest of Phoenix, which was in the area of the Barry Goldwater Training Range.
Uh-huh.
Furthermore, I could determine that these things had an angular elevation, that is, the lights are at some angular elevation above the horizon. And when I projected that out to the distance, it turned out to be 10 to 15,000 feet, and the Maryland National Guard guy said, "Well, we had dropped light flares, you know, from 10,000 to 15,000 feet," words to that effect.
Right.
High-altitude flare drops, which were not usual, but they were... More and more of the stories come out just recently within the last year or so, and one of the guys who was flying said, you know, well, we had a whole bunch of flares, and we had to drop them before we landed. We were using up all our flares. We didn't want to take any home.
Right.
So this is their last day of activity, and then the Maryland National Guard is going to leave the next day, so they dropped all their flares. Well, there were 8 flares per airplane. In the total history of that night, there was an appearance of a single light, which is what caused Mike Kristen to turn his camera on. And this single light was sitting there. There might have been a couple other individual lights. But the point is, he had his camera going when all of a sudden this arc of lights started. That's a good thing. Because if you watch it very carefully, you can see that the arc of lights is made up of a total of 8 lights that appear one after another. Bing, 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 like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that each plane carried 8 flares. So what I could imagine is that there were a couple of planes, you know, that had like one flare apiece, and they threw those out. And then one guy, in traveling eastward, roughly, from the Goldwater Training Range area to Tucson, from the viewpoint of Phoenix, that is going from right to left. So it's going from right to left in the video.
Right.
And sure enough, these 8 images, these 8 little flare lights that turn on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, are going from right to left in an arc. So I imagine, you know, there was one plane that hadn't used any of his flares. He threw all 8 of them out, one after another.
Right.
And the point is that there's a lot of consistency. The witnesses still argued that, it couldn't be flares because they didn't move. Well, by using digitizing the pictures and looking very carefully at the angular elevations of the lights above fixed lights on the ground, I could prove that they did. They dropped downwards and moved to the left. Well, the general flow of the atmosphere was from west towards the east, which, since you're looking southward from Phoenix, means from right to left.
Mm-hmm.
And so these things were falling downwards, and you could even calculate the rate of fall. It turned out to be comparable to what you'd expect. And the durations, these lights They said the lights lasted a long time. Well, that's a collective statement. But if you looked at any one particular light, none of them lasted more than 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
which is the maximum burn time of these LUU2 flares that they drop. Most of them lasted for less than that. Well, I mean, all of them lasted for less than 5 minutes. Most of them lasted for less than 4 minutes.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of technical details, but the bottom line is the triangulation put it way south of Phoenix, and sort of consistent with the flare theory. So my argument is the UFO was a dark triangle at 8:30, and at 10 a.m., the people saw these flares way out, and they were off on the horizon. The flares were not overhead. Nobody
right.
was looking straight
right.
up at the flares.
And the two events got mingled.
Right. mingled because they happened the same night. Some people would argue that, well, it was done intentionally because the black triangle flew over and the Air Force immediately sent up planes to introduce disinformation into the sighting.
Yeah, well, I don't think so.
The Maryland National Guard claimed that they had been, you know, doing training stuff for a week beforehand or something like that.
Right.
And this was our last day, and it was all planned ahead of time. And
I'm sure. There's been so many reports of triangles. How many times have they dropped flares, you know what I mean?
No, yeah, right. Yeah. I don't think they've ever dropped
flares. Right. So, Ed Walters is a person that became famous for his Gulf Breeze, Florida UFO photos.
Right.
MUFON worked with him to ensure that his photos were genuine. I think they gave him a sealed camera, if I remember right.
Right.
Can you tell us about the photos and what MUFON had done, if you know?
Yeah, well, of course, that's a monumental case to talk about because there's so many aspects to it. You have Ed Walters as a standalone person. He and his family, his whole family were witnesses at various times, but he took all these pictures, which is what attracted the attention of everybody to the sightings. What is not known or generally ignored by skeptics is that there were dozens of other people who claimed they saw the same thing. And we're talking about starting in November of 1987. Actually, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary now. Or the 20th anniversary.
Time flies.
Yeah, flying ties. 20th anniversary will be November 11th of this year. And I haven't really heard anything from Ed for about 5 or 6 years now, so I don't know what he's doing. But from November 1987, well, about for the next 10 years, he had activity that is sightings. But from 1990 or so onwards, his sightings were sporadic, like maybe one or two a year.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, produced some spectacular pictures, but some of which have never been published. But the main activity in Gulf Breeze started in November of 87 and lasted through 1992 and could be divided into two phases. One might be called the Ed Walters phase from November 1987 until July or so of 1988, when most of the pictures were taken, and especially in the spring of 88, there were dozens of other witnesses. And then the Red Bubba sightings that started in November 1990 and lasted until July 1992. Ed was a witness to those, but so were literally hundreds of other people. Gulf Breeze was so famous by the early 90s that news media would send people there to videotape stuff. Very often they were successful. You could, for a period of time, you could almost guarantee if you went down there and stayed 2 weeks, you're going to see something. Anyway, with reference to Ed himself, you know, I initially assumed that this was a big hoax on the Meyer level because of the number of photographs involved. Initially, I only knew of five, and then when I began the investigation in February of 88, by that time, he had already taken a dozen pictures.
Right.
I only knew of five of them at that point, and when I was flabbergasted to find out that there were more. And I went to his house, and, you know, with the MUFON investigators, and we grilled him we spent a whole day with him. Including borrowing his truck to go and try to test out or look at the famous Roadshot area, sort of scope that out, you know, where mm-hmm. I was asking how could this be fake, and all this turned out to be, well, if it's going to be a fake, it's going to be a double exposure using his Polaroid camera, and I, in fact, created such a double exposure and, image and showed it to him. He didn't know what the hell was going on. Either he was a great actor or he knew nothing about what was what I had just done.
Mm-hmm.
I created a light up in the sky right out in front of his house with his camera.
Did you really?
Yeah. And he was wandering around looking up in the sky thinking, gee, they came back again.
Oh, geez.
So like I said, either was a great actor and extemporaneous. I mean, he could make up everything as he's going along, or else he really didn't know what the hell was going on. And it was my conclusion over many months of investigation that he didn't know what the hell was going on. He was the first person to ever take stereo photographs.
Really? Yeah.
Now, you mentioned this sealed camera.
Right.
He had, by that time, taken, I don't know, 20 pictures or something like that, had a dozen events, some of which produced more than one picture. A dozen events, I forget, since it's been 20 years now since I've been thinking about this. 10 years ago, I could have recited the whole thing practically, but whatever. He had a number of pictures taken. What was that? About the time of lost my train of thought because I had several different.
You were saying that he had dozens of pictures taken.
Right. What? He had dozens of pictures taken by the time I got involved. And the big question was, of course, how are these faked? And as I said, it came down using his doing double exposures with his camera. Well, so they gave him a sealed camera with the understanding that, if he takes a UFO photo with this camera, we'll know it wasn't a fake, or at least it wasn't a double exposure.
Right.
And furthermore, they used what's known as a Nimslo camera, which has got four lenses on it, used for creating special type of pictures that are, you look at one of these special types of pseudo 3D pictures where you tilt it left and you tilt it to the right and you see different images.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any case, because you had four lenses, the outer two lenses were spaced about 2.5 inches. That means that you have the opportunity for getting parallax, which is viewing something, the same thing, from two different directions.
Right.
And getting an angle between the two different directions. And if you know the distance between your viewing points, in this case 2.5 inches, and you can measure the angle with respect to each viewing point, and the angles, the sighting lines cross, and where the sighting lines cross is how far the object was away from you.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't tell him that. All we told him was that with four lenses, we got four different copies of the same picture. Each time you take a picture, we got four copies of it. We can send it to different UFO analysts. Well, Ed always acted as if he was happy to have people analyze his pictures because he wanted it to be proven that, he was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You can make the same judgment for a hoaxer wanting to be told that he's telling the truth, but a typical hoaxer would not do anything that would be likely to tip his hand as to how he was doing it. Whereas Ed was always open to doing any experiment we wanted to do. So with this four-lens camera, a week or 2 weeks or something before he saw something, but he actually, in company with his wife, saw an object fly by, and he took a series of 10 pictures of it. All these pictures came out, he took the pictures, and then there was the press was always interested, the local press was always interested in what was going on because of all the news media surrounding these photographs. They opened the camera at a particular date in front of the press and took the film out and had it developed. And it showed a strange collection of lights, which according to Ed was moving from left to right behind a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Or part of the time it was behind a tree. So it took weeks to get that camera calibrated and do all the calculations, but it turned out that this thing was 2.5 feet long and 40 feet away. It turned out that when the camera, when Ed had told me long before I got the, well, long before the analysis was done, he had told me where he was standing when he took the pictures, and there was a tree there, and the top of the tree was about 40 feet from the camera, 35
right.
feet or something like that. And he said, you know, the object went behind that tree. Well, it turns out that this parallax proved that the object was 40 or more feet away. I couldn't be absolutely sure how far away it was because 2.5 inches is not a very big parallactic spacing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this type of arrangement, array of lights, was a unique thing. It was not the shape of the Ed Walters UFO that people had become accustomed to, with the so-called power ring at the bottom, you know, and it looked like a lampshade almost.
Yeah, right.
It would, rectangular dark areas around it that were called windows but probably weren't, and it had a light on the top and so on. Anyway, this thing taken with a Nimzo camera was different. And it was clearly 2.5 to some couple of feet in size probably. And so anyway, the most important aspect is that because Ed was willing to do this with a Nimzo camera, and I told him this before we had the analysis of the Nimzo camera results. I said, well, you know, it would be really neat if you want to try to prove that these objects are far away, instead of doing something with a camera that has a 2-inch spacing, 2.5-inch spacing of lenses, why not make a camera with a foot spacing? Now I said, you know, get two. He had bought himself a Model 600 Polaroid camera.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, he had been using an old type of Polaroid where you take a picture, you pull the film out a certain distance, and then you wait 60 seconds for the film to develop, and then you open the back of the camera and pull the film out.
Right.
That's the old original Polaroid.
Oh, I remember those.
Now, that one was easy to take double exposures because the film, the first picture you take exposes the film, and then you could expose the film again, you know, keep clicking the shutter as many times as you want
mm-hmm.
before you pull the film out to develop it.
Right.
Well, with a Model 600 camera, which you can still buy, I believe, you push the button and it takes the picture and the mechanism immediately ejects the film. In other words, there's no time to take another photograph.
Right, right.
So he bought himself a Model 600, which he thought would be better provide better evidence if he could get some pictures with it. By this time, he'd actually taken a picture with that. And I then suggested, well, you know, if you could get another one, you put two of them 1 foot apart, and we can get parallactic measurements of distance out to maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 feet, 100 feet, depending on how accurate the cameras are. Now, this had been a hoax guy who was using a small model close up, which is what the arguments were. He would, you know, the idea of doing a stereo photo would be a no-no.
Right.
Because it would immediately pick out 10 feet to a several-inch size model as opposed to 100 feet, you know, to a full-size UFO. Well, to my great surprise, he did me 1 foot better. He built a camera that had a spacing of 2 feet between the cameras. This gave us a possibility of resolving things out to a couple of 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And over the next month or so, he actually got a couple of pictures with that. Let's see, I think he took three photographs, the most important by far being May 1, 1988. Which was at when apparently an abduction occurred. He took the pictures of the craft, but not only did he get the standard Ed-type craft, the light on the top and the power ring on the bottom and so on, this photo also has the Nimzo-type craft in it. And these photos clearly were taken looking over the Santa Rosa Sound. In other words, he was standing on the shore, he said,
mm-hmm.
and you can see the lights on the bridge that go across Santa Rosa Sound from Gulf Breeze to Pensacola Beach. You can see the lights on the bridge, and they allowed for calibrating of the camera. I mean, everything worked out beautifully. The Nimzo-type device, the parallax, said that thing was 100 or so feet away out over the water, 2.5 feet in size. It agreed perfectly with what the Nimzo camera size was. And the Ed-type UFO, the typical one, was 400 feet away, as I recall, a couple of 100 or 200 feet above the water. So these things were out over the water. Kind of hard to imagine faking that.
Yeah, it really is, yeah, unless it's some kind of flying model.
But I know they found a model, as a matter of fact, in his house after he moved out, but it was like 6 months later.
Yeah, that
it sounds actually, like a put-up job, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was actually, he moved out of his house in December of 1988, I believe it was. He built houses down there, so he would build one, live in it for a while, and move out, build another one, move out into the new house, and sell the old one. So he moved out, I think it was December 89 when he actually succeeded in selling the house. It was essentially empty for nearly a year while he was trying to sell it. And it gets to be a very complicated story, but the new owner wanted to install a ice-making refrigerator in the house. Ed had had an ice-making refrigerator, so in the kitchen there was a pipe sticking out of the wall. Well, now, the standard thing is the little pipe comes, you know, if you're at all familiar with ice-making refrigerators, they have to have a source of water.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Okay, so you have a little pipe coming out of the wall, and typically you have a shut-off valve.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you do or not. A shut-off valve
I
somewhere.
Huh? Of course I do.
Okay, a shut-off valve somewhere so you can decouple the refrigerator and take it away.
Right.
And have water pour on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ed says I turned off my shut-off valve. It was sticking out of the wall. Turned off my shut-off valve, took the refrigerator off, and moved out. So the house is now open, empty for a year. And during that time, the house was open for inspection numerous times. And so when the new guy bought the house in December, whatever it was, of 1989, early 90s, March or something like that, or January, he decides to connect up his refrigerator. Well, he looks at the pipe down there, and it's crimped. Get this.
Mm-hmm.
Ed left it with a valve on it.
Right.
The new guy finds the pipe is crimped. So he figures, well, there must be a shutoff valve somewhere. He knows there's no piping underground under the floor in Florida. So he goes up into the attic. And he goes up into the attic to find the shutoff valve for this little pipe that supplies the water for the refrigerator. And he locates a position over which he believes is over the refrigerator, and he feels down inside the blown-in insulation between the floor and the ceiling joists, if you wish. And he finds the pipe, and he starts feeling his way along the pipe, expecting to find a valve. And as he's feeling away along the pipe, up pops this paper and styrofoam plate model of a UFO.
Yeah.
And he thinks, that's interesting. So he continues along the pipe, and he doesn't find any shutoff valve. This is up in the attic over the house.
Right.
But the stairway to the attic was actually in the garage. In other words, so people could leave the garage open, for example, and lock the doors to the house, and somebody could get up into the attic but not get into the house.
Right.
Anyway, He didn't throw the model away. He just put it on a shelf for safekeeping. I thought it was an amusing thing. He knew about roughly about the sightings before, but you know that's it all happened more than a year before he had actually moved in. So he just knew vaguely about it. He thought, well, maybe somebody built a model UFO. I don't know what he thought. Bottom line is, he put it up on a shelf, and then he had to call up Ed. Unfortunately, he didn't mention finding this model. If he had, this whole thing would have probably been resolved right at that point. But he asked Ed, you know, how do I shut off the water? And Ed says, well, it's the main shut off at a certain location. You have to shut off the water for the whole house just to be able to do this thing with the refrigerator. And the guy didn't mention anything about the pipe being crimped. Ed didn't think anything about it. So that was essentially the end of it as far as Ed was concerned.
Hmm.
The guy was able to install his refrigerator. Well, Ed's book, The Gulf Breeze Sightings, came out in March of 1990, March of April of 1990. In the lead-up to that, the Pensacola newspaper, which had followed these sightings with all the controversy over faking and so on, Pensacola newspaper did a big story on Ed's sightings and really emphasized the other witnesses who had seen the same thing, including the county coroner and his wife, who claimed they had seen this thing early one morning hovering out over the water not far from their house. Now, that's kind of solid testimony right there.
Sounds like it, huh?
So this newspaper story, and then I was told by the author of the newspaper, who, by the way, has written a book that just came out within the last year about these sightings, although I haven't seen it. Anyway, he told me that he was canvassing the neighborhood to see if there were any sightings besides at Edge, you know, if anybody had any information. Well, it turned out that he canvassed one house, Ed's house, what was Ed's house, and this new guy by the name of Robert Menzer was in the house, and Menzer testifies as follows. A guy knocks on the door, he goes to the door, and says, I'm a reporter from Pensacola News. I'd like there have been sightings around here. I'd like some more information. Have you seen any UFOs? And Menzer says, nope. And the next question was, well, have you seen any photographs of UFOs lying around? And Menzer's answer is nope. And the third question is, well, have you seen any models lying around?
That's just a coincidence, right? don't they always ask that question?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God. Well, you know, I've taken up an hour and 15 minutes of your time, and believe me, I could go on all day. But that wouldn't be fair to you.
So could I, but my voice would give out.
Could I ask you one or two more questions, and then we'll end the interview?
Sure.
Great. Thanks very much. One question I wanted to ask you was about the moon photos. A lot of people claim we didn't land on the moon because they claim that the photos, some of the photos, the backgrounds are the same, even though the locations were different. Have you ever looked at any of these photos?
Well, I've read some of the stuff about the argument that's been presented. I didn't actually see the Fox show that presented it, the TV show that presented these arguments, what, in 2002 or something like that?
Well, I've seen it all over the Internet, you know, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've seen shows, too, on it, of course.
Yeah, well, there are also websites which, shall we say, debunk the debunkers, I guess.
Well, they talk about
First of all, I don't buy the arguments.
Uh-huh.
Second of all, I don't know about the specific thing that you're talking about, the background being the same.
Well, they claim that there's like
they claim that they can't see the stars, and therefore you should be able to see the stars, but you've got a huge amount of glare from the surface of the moon.
Well, I'm talking about like these mountains, or hills, maybe is a better term for them, on the moon, you know. They claim that some of the pictures that were taken have the same hills behind them, even though they were in different locations.
I don't know about that. There are arguments about shadow lengths. Arguments about the shadows not seeming to come from two different light sources.
Exactly, yeah.
And as I recall, if there had been two light sources, then each astronaut would have had two shadows instead of just one.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but the picture they refer to as a shadow, each astronaut only has one shadow. It's just the shadows don't seem to point in the same direction. But that can also be a phenomenon of parallax, you know, like if you stand in the middle of the road and you look at the sides of the road, the sides don't seem to be parallel.
Mm-hmm.
As you go off into the distance, they converge. So parallel lines can appear to be non-parallel depending on how you look at them.
Right, right.
Anyway, you know, trying to refute all their arguments, it's not impossible to do. You can probably do a Google search on moon hoax or something and find sites that.
Oh, there's tons of them.
Huh?
Yeah, there's tons of them all over the internet.
Yeah.
My son believes that we didn't land on the moon. As a matter of fact.
Well, you know, the argument is one argument was that there was apparently predictions of success were so low that. NASA decided, well, we'll do it on the ground.
Yeah, right.
We'll set up a rocket, let it stay up there in space rotating. There won't be any astronauts in it. You know, it would have been an exceedingly difficult thing to pull off in the glare of the press and all the people who would have been involved. And that no one would have come forward and said, oh, by the way, Armstrong was at Hoboken, New Jersey, when he claimed that he was standing on the moon.
The last question. Have you ever seen any photos of the UFO that was over O'Hare Airport?
Well, I've seen photos that they claimed, but, you know, I haven't seen anything that's been guaranteed. And so far as I know, I don't know that there are any, although I don't know for sure that there aren't either. I haven't been involved directly with that investigation.
I know there's one, and it was purchased by that comedian from Saturday Night Live. I can't remember his name. Oh, Dan Aykroyd.
Oh,
yeah, Dan Aykroyd supposedly purchased it. He's going to put it out on his next DVD.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know what it shows. I don't know anything about it.
Okay. And at this point, I'd like you to be able to say anything you would like to say.
Well, I appreciate your interview, and wish you good luck with your future endeavors.
Well, thank you, and I do the same with you.